London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we reveal the complicated code by which British silverware can be dated. We offer you a potted coach guide to the English countryside, and we paint a profile, not very flattering either, of England's patron saint, St. George. And it's only fitting that we should begin with him. The 23rd of April is the day when England remembers St. George and conjures up glowing mental images of the heroic knight in plumed helm, holding his rearing steed with horsemanship worthy of Hopalong Cassidy, while his blood-tipped lance stands quivering in the dragon's corpse like a redskin's arrow stuck in the stockade. Well, just off London's busy Regent Street, this saintly mythology comes to life, or something rather like life, every quarter of an hour. In an archway connecting two blocks of a department store, just 100 yards from this studio, there's one of the most curious clocks in the world. And to tell you about it and St. George, here's Tom Masson.
In a canopy above the beautiful gilt dial of this clock are coloured figures of George and the Dragon. At each quarter hour, as the Westminster chimes ring out, George chases the Dragon round a track within the canopy, and at each hour, after they've gone round four times, St. George stabs the Dragon with his lance at each stroke of the hour bell. This is probably the most novel way in which St. George is commemorated. But of course, April 23rd is St. George's Day. Now, who was this George who is the soldier saint and whose red cross on a white ground forms the center of the Union Jack? We are told that the great warriors of Britain used to dash into battle with rallying cries of St. George. But his story, which goes back to about the year 250, is very, very obscure. In fact, there are several stories. One is that he was born of good Christian parents, entered the army, and by diligence and hard work got himself promoted to a very high rank. When the Emperor Diocletian persecuted the Christians, George didn't like the idea, so he threw up his commission and told the Emperor what he thought of him. For this, he was decapitated and became a saint almost overnight. The very dull story, I'm afraid, of a very good boy. But this other story is more interesting. According to Gibbons, George didn't gain his saintly position through any merit of his own. It appears that he lived in complete obscurity somewhere in a part of Asia Minor known as Cappadocia. But being a bit of a wide boy, he made a point of getting in with those above him and eventually landed a contract to supply the army with bacon. Needless to say, as an army contractor, he made a fortune and had to flee the country before his dishonest conduct came to light. He later ingratiated himself with the emperor and was made Archbishop of Alexandria. Here again, the avarice of this Cappadocian spiv dominated. And after 5 years of extracting the most fabulous taxes, he was torn to pieces by an infuriated public and thrown into the sea. Maybe George did kill a dragon, but lots of the saints did that in those far-off legendary times. So it would appear that St. George's press agents over the centuries must have convinced the historians that the dragon he did in was a very big monster indeed.
One of the features of British silverware, spoons and forks and cigarette cases, golfing trophies, quaiches, bowls and candlesticks, or anything else in genuine sterling silver, one of the features is the collection of symbols and figures and letters that you can find stamped on them, sometimes quite minutely. There are usually four of these marks: the initials of the maker, the grade of purity of the metal, the town of the assay or test, and the year of the assay. Well, it's quite a complicated business, really, and these hallmarks, as they're called, are of particular importance to collectors, especially collectors of antique silver. And we've asked the clerk of the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths, George Hughes, to tell you why.
The term hallmark had its origin at Goldsmiths' Hall in London as far back as the 14th century. Since then, it has achieved international significance. It's now universally recognized as a sign of integrity and of the high quality which British traders and craftsmen have been trying to maintain for hundreds of years. King Edward I ruled by statute that no gold or silverware should be sold, until it had been tested by the guardians of the craft and marked with a leopard's head, which was originally taken from the Royal Arms. At a later date, this leopard's head became the town mark of London, and for the last 6 centuries, it has been used day by day in the Assay Office of Goldsmiths Hall. Later, other Assay Offices were opened, each of which is controlled by a board of guardians or wardens and had its individual town mark. For Birmingham, it is an anchor. For Sheffield, a crown on silver and a York rose on gold. For Chester, it is a sword between two wheat sheaves. For Edinburgh, a castle. And for Glasgow, a composite mark with a tree, a bird, a bell, a fish, and a ring. Such then are the hallmarks derived from this ancient and honourable craft, which is still producing craftsmen who can work, whose work can compare in design, inventiveness, and skill with that of any of their predecessors of the past 600 years.
And now, just in case you imagine that the only way to travel in Britain is by rail or by car or bicycle or airplane, according to the depth of your purse, there's a very highly organized system of long-distance buses, which lace the trunk roads and the byways equally, and indeed travel at the kind of speed, neither breakneck nor crawling, that lets you see the almond and the cherry and the prunus trees in blossom, and see all the varied countryside in plenty of comfort and with no trouble at all. And there's almost no part of these islands that you can't get to by bus, long distance or local, as Howard Marshall can tell you.
There are a great many coach tours to choose from, but let's look at one or two of them. You can, for example, go from London to Edinburgh. A two-day journey, staying at Harrogate. And then when you've seen Edinburgh, that most beautiful city, then you can go for a week to the Northern Highlands, the Trossachs, the Grampians, Royal Deeside, Inverness, John O'Groats, Glencoe, Loch Lomond. What an experience that'd be. And then south again from Edinburgh to the Lake District, through the border country, to sail or fish on Derwent Water in lovely mountain country, and then south again, looking in at Blackpool for a glimpse of a kind of British Coney Island, down to North Wales and Snowdonia with its mountains and trout streams and green valleys, and then, by way of contrast, to Birmingham. If industry interests you, you'll be invited to see great manufacturing plants. And so on to the West Country, to Devon and Cornwall, and your road would take you over the Malvern Hills, along the Wye Valley, most beautiful valley, and a river full of salmon. You'd see Tintern Abbey and the cities of Gloucester and Bristol. You'd go down through Somerset, wild Exmoor and Dartmoor. You'd visit Bath and Plymouth and Torquay, St. Ives, Land's End, St. Michael's Mount. The list's endless. And so back to London, through the Cotswold country, Fairford, Lechlade, Cricklade, where the Thames rises, Burford and Oxford, and through Stratford-on-Avon and Broadway and the orchards of the Vale of Evesham. Well, I can hardly bear to recite the names, so much do they make me long to be up and away myself. And all this you could see in 3 weeks or so, from the wild grandeur of the Highlands to the kindly hills and meadows of the South Country. And all along your road, the monuments of history, cathedrals and castles, houses great and small where famous men and women lived, Elizabethan manor houses, thatched cottages, inns hundreds of years old, towns and villages which still have about them a serenity, a sense of the Middle Ages.
Which brings us to this week's postscript, which has nothing to do with travel or silver or St. George, a postscript from London columnist Alan Melville.
Alan?
This is Alan Melville speaking. I'm always delighted when something of interest happens during the week in London which is not covered by any of the three speakers in the column. And this week, there was such an event. 100 years ago last Monday, a remarkable little woman called Mary Tussaud, T-U-S-S-A-U-D, died. The name may perhaps not mean a great deal to you, but if you're over here this year, Do take in as one of the sights of London Madame Tussaud's exhibition in the Marylebone Road. It's the finest and most famous collection of waxworks in the world, and in it you'll find many thousands of absolutely lifelike reproductions of everyone from your president to Rasputin. Marie Tussaud was born in Bern in Switzerland in 1801, and she was a quite extraordinary little person. She was little, under 5 feet, in fact, but what she lacked in inches, she made up for in spirit. She began making wax models for her uncle, who was a doctor in Paris, and her great-great-grandson, Bernard Tussaud, is the man who makes the models in the Marylebone Road today. She was imprisoned during the French Revolution, but because of her skill as a modeler, she was one of the very few who escaped with her life. She can't have had a very pleasant time in jail, however, because every time the guillotine crashed down, which it did a great many times in the course of a day, the victim's head was thrown into Mary's cell, and she was told, "Model that." So the heads of such celebrities and notorieties as Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI, Robespierre and the rest, can be seen today along with the heads of Danny Kaye and gorgeous Gussie Moran in the present exhibition. She managed to get out of France and away to England, chiefly by modelling a rather flattering head of Napoleon and then asking for a passport, and she set up her waxworks here in London, and here they've been ever since. Not without their share of troubles. The exhibition building was gutted by fire in 1925, and one of the first £1,000 bombs to be dropped on London in the last war fell smack on Madame Tussaud's. Fortunately, the original casts of the models were saved on both occasions, and the show goes on as one of London's surefire attractions. They did a programme on TV on Monday night to mark the anniversary of Mary's death. And though I suppose it isn't quite the thing to talk about TV on sound radio, it turned out to be a very interesting way of bringing history, some rather grim and gruesome history, right into one's sitting room. When a smooth and suave BBC announcer in a well-fitting tuxedo tells you that so-and-so opened the doors of the Bastille and adds, "with this key," it makes you think. When, with the help of a couple of assistants, he says, "and this is the original blade of the guillotine, which chopped off the heads you see on the table over there. Careful, Joe, it's sharp." It makes you think even harder. Madame Tussaud's is crammed with relics like that, as well as with the thousands of figures, each of which is dressed correctly in every detail. In the case of the moderns, the figures wear suits or dresses presented by the living originals. The one figure whom Bernard Tussaud has not been able to wheedle a suit out of is Stalin. They had to have one made at the tailor's to cover him up. A number of uniformed attendants stand around to answer people's questions, and as some of these are real and some wax, and you can't tell which is which, a good time is had by all. So don't miss it when you are in London. It's a remarkable memorial to a little lady who kept her head by preserving other people's. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. Was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.